While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Good afternoon, Namibia, and welcome to On the Radar News Analysis right here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. I'm your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and welcome to today's session of Tuesday, the 2nd of June 2026. It's a pleasure to keep you company again and inform you about news that is happening around Namibia and within Namibia. Now, a new month is underway. June arrives carrying fresh expectations, renewed ambitions, and a new set of opportunities for a nation in motion. Across Namibia, from Walvis Bay to Rundu, Windhoek to Katimamulilo, Ketmanshoop to Oshakati, businesses, communities, institutions, and households are setting their focus on what the weeks ahead may bring. At the beginning of every month, attention naturally shifts from reflection to execution. The plans discussed, the budgets approved, the commitments made and the promises delivered all begin to face their first real test. Now, June is not just another page in the calendar. It is a critical point in the year where momentum must translate into measurable progress, because it's a month right behind the mid of the year month. Now, today we examine the signals shaping Namibia's economic and development landscape as the month begins. From investment activity and infrastructure delivery to industrial growth and employment creation, we ask a simple but important question: where is momentum accelerating and where are challenges demanding greater attention? And we continue monitoring Namibia's evolving role in regional and global markets, green industrialization, energy development, logistics expansion, and economic diversification remain central themes as the country positions itself for long-term competitiveness in a rapidly changing world. Now, the decisions, pardon me, made this month could have implications far beyond June itself, and we see it among the oil and gas economy. Now, young Namibians continue to drive innovation and transformation across multiple sectors, from technology and entrepreneurship to creative industries and emerging enterprises. Their contribution is becoming increasingly visible. As opportunities evolve, the question remains whether systems, institutions, and policy frameworks are moving with the same urgency and pace. We will also be tracking governance in action beyond announcements and policy statements. The focus tends to implementation, accountability, and measurable outcomes. As projects advance and priorities are activated, we will assess where the progress is being achieved and where greater coordination may be required. And as always, we remain connected to the realities experienced by ordinary Namibians, because economic indicators, investment figures, and national strategies ultimately matter most when they improve lives and strengthen communities and create tangible opportunities for people on the ground. Now, over the next 90 minutes, expect informed analysis, meaningful conversations, and perspectives that help make sense of the issues that are shaping Namibia's month ahead. Now, right here on the Radar, here on Eagle FM, we don't just follow the story, we track its direction and report about it. Let's get right into today's discussion, the debate around a basic income grant, also known as BIG in Namibia, being one of the country's longest running social policy discussions, more than 20 years after it was first proposed. Namibia still does not have a universal basic income grant, but the idea continues to influence government social protection programs. Let's give you a bit of background. After independence, Namibia remained one of the world's most unequal countries. Large numbers of people faced unemployment, poverty, and limited access to economic opportunities despite economic growth. Now, in 2002, the government appointed Namibia Tax Consortium, also known as NAMTAX, recommended a basic income grant as a way to redistribute income and reduce poverty. The proposal suggested that every Namibian should receive a monthly cash payment regardless of income, with wealthier citizens effectively paying it back through tax. The Ochivero Omitara pilot of 2000, which ran from 2008 to 2009, now was one of the most important chapter in Namibia's big story, which took place in the settlement of Ochivero Omitara, about 100 kilometers east of Windhoek. A coalition of churches, trade unions, NGOs or non-governmental organizations and researchers launched a pilot project where every resident under 60 years old received 100 Namibian dollars per month. Around 1,000 people benefited from this pilot. Researchers reported several positive outcomes: reduced hunger and child malnutrition, increased school attendance, lower crime levels, growth of small businesses such as dressmaking, bricklaying, and repair services, more money circulating within their local economy. And a practical example was imagining an unemployed person receiving 100 Namibian dollars every month in 2008. That money was not enough to live on, but it could have or helped with buying basic food items, help pay for transport to look for work, purchase materials for a small income generating activity, reduce dependency on debt from local shopkeepers. And the idea was not that people would stop working, rather they would have a minimum level of security from which to pursue economic opportunities. But before we continue with this interesting story, please stay tuned as we pause for a scheduled commercial break right here on the Radar News Analysis. Stay tuned.
Great news! Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Now, why wasn't it implemented nationwide? That was the question. Despite positive pilot results, the government never adopted a universal BIC or universal basic income grant. Several reasons are frequently cited, one of them being cost concerns. A nationwide grant would require substantial government funding. Indeed, in a case of 3 million people receiving 100 Namibian dollars per month. Political disagreements about whether unconditional cash grants are the best way to reduce poverty. And looking from this pilot study, actually, cash might be the best option to help reduce poverty. Of course, some people may not use it entirely to better themselves, but there could be people who use it to better their livelihoods, and that on its own will make an impact. Imagine a household of 7 people, and each of them under 60 are receiving 100 Namibian dollars, plus the pensioner who is probably 65 years old receiving their monthly income of 1,000, is it 300, which has increased now? It would make a difference. Now, competing social protection approaches, including food banks, targeted grants, and other welfare programs, questions raised by some economists and researchers about the methodology and the implementation of the pilot results. Now, what exists today, Namibia has several targeted social grants, including old age pensions, disability grants, and child-related grants. Now, to your shock, what I have come to realize about the child related grants, that which is given to parents who are unemployed or perhaps employed, but should not be earning at least a minimum, should not be earning more than 1,500. Now, that's ridiculous in my opinion, because even somebody who's earning a basic, who's earning a basic income of 1,500 will still need, and has probably has 3 or 5 kids, will still benefit very much from that 350 that is given to each child, because 1,500 is barely even able to care for them alone. More recently, the government introduced a conditional basic income grant for certain vulnerable households, particularly former food bank beneficiaries. And this is not a universal basic income grant. It is targeted and conditional. The program provides cash transfers of $600 million per household to eligible beneficiaries. In terms of how far has Namibia come? Well, if we measure progress against the original vision, a universal grant paid to every Namibian, the country is still some very long distance away. Or perhaps, let me not say long distance. You never know what the government could be cooking. Every now and then, new ideas pop up. To our surprise, we didn't know something was being cooked. And we applaud. So let me not. But it is some, seems to be some distance away. Now, what has been achieved? Big moved from theory to a real world pilot. Evidence was gathered on poverty reduction. Cash transfer programs became more accepted in policy discussions. And the idea continues to be debated in parliament and civil society. What remains unresolved? Funding and national grant. Determining the grant amount. Deciding whether it should be universal or targeted, integrating it with existing social welfare programs. Now, practical context for Namibia today. For many unemployed Namibians between the age of 18 and 59 years old, there is still no broad unemployment grant available. This creates what many policy analysts call a social protection gap. People who are too young for pensions do not qualify for disability grants and may not have dependent children often. And may not have dependent children often receive little or no direct income support. Now, the National Council recently highlighted this issue and recommended stronger support mechanism for unemployed adults. In simple terms, the big debate is really about one question. Should every Namibian be granted a minimum cash income simply because they are citizens, or should assistance continue to be targeted only at specific vulnerable groups? And the others may question to say, what about us? But nonetheless, we caught up with one of big or basic income grant coordinators, that is Renani Mustatua. Let's take a listen to that interesting conversation. Please do stay tuned. Okay, a very good afternoon to you, Ms. Renani Mustatua, and welcome to On the Radio News Analysis. It's a pleasure to have you with me.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Mm. Of course, today we're going back down memory lane to discuss about the basic income grant. You know, back in the days, it was really up. Namibians were feeling like, yes, perhaps we're going to get somewhere with people fighting for us in regards to the basic income grant. But let's get into you discussing about the basic income grant, what it is and what it aims to achieve or aims to achieve.
The basic income grant was actually an idea that was invented by a tax commission that was appointed by former president Hifikepunye Pohamba.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to look at how to increase tax collection and at the same time use that to reduce poverty and inequality in Namibia.
Yeah.
And his own appointed tax commission came up with that idea of, at that time in 2002, give each Namibian, regardless of their status, economic status, $100 Namibian.
Mm-hmm.
And that would give every poor Namibian a chance not to miss out on that, because once you put up barriers for people to go through, hoops that they would have to go through to prove that they are poor and that they are worthy. You're already making it difficult for them to receive the help that they deserve. That is a human right that would have helped their life a little bit. And on top of that, that would also help improve the economy because people would have buying power.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of would have helped everybody. But then, unfortunately, the advice wasn't taken on by the president at that time. And that people would get lazy. And then civil society decided they were going to take up that campaign, the issue that was rejected, that would have given a lot of Namibians some sort of dignity.
Yeah.
They were trying to convince the government then to introduce the grant, and they tried up to the extent whereby they got aid from Germany and Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
To aid a pilot project in Oshivero Omitara to prove to government that this thing is magic, it can be done in Namibia, whereby each resident of Oshivero Omitara was receiving 100 Namibian dollars. Mm-hmm. Each and everyone up to the age of 60, because then you automatically in Namibia you get a pension grant. And that thing did magic. There were less kids on the street. The kids were attending school more. They even opened up the post office because there was money flowing around, and that really also helped, you know, the little economy that they had at that settlement.
Yeah.
The magic that it did, there are statistics. It's proven, and that was the first pilot study in the world, and the whole world took from Namibia, and they all did their studies, and that was ours was the first one, and
mm-hmm.
the results were always the same,
mm-hmm.
whether it was in a rich country in Europe, Finland, Canada, and they do that in even Alaska,
mm-hmm.
where they have a grant for each and every citizen, and it really reduced poverty. And then people started using less drugs, and then everything just improved because people could use that money in the future to pay for their university education. And it's proven over and over and over again, but nobody is listening. We really do not know why.
Mm.
And we keep campaigning and campaigning. Like, campaigning doesn't mean like you are there picking up guns.
Yeah.
No, just trying to tell people the truth. Mm-hmm. Of what a basic income grant could do. Not the conditional grant that they have right now. It is actually a Harambe grant that was converted, because it was the food grant that was converted into that later 600 Namibian dollars. That's not a universal basic. I mean, that's not a basic income grant, because mm-hmm. a basic income grant is, in essence, everybody is treated the same, regardless, so that you can give everybody a chance. But then in other manners, you can find to get back a little bit from the ones that have too much, so you can also help the others that don't have much, so they can also live dignified human being, human lives.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same thing. So that is why we keep on campaigning or advocating, continuously advocating for the basic income grant, because that grant only targets 0.5% of the 1.6 million people that are starving. It's a drop in the ocean.
I hear you.
And we really, really hope that at some stage somebody's going to listen. And we are hoping on the mother of the nation to listen to the plight of her people, because we cannot go around and look at other people looking for food in bins and sleeping on the streets and doing drugs and not having any hope, because this life is supposed to be better than that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Questions also come in and arise to say, for those who are especially addicted to drugs and, let's say, also alcohol, would there be perhaps also mechanisms to help them not to use the income grant, should it be granted, to sustain, you know, those addictions? Will there perhaps be assistance to do that? Because I think fears also come in to say we might be funding their lifestyle even the more.
But the thing is that drug is done by everyone, whether they are rich or poor.
Mm.
Everybody does it. And the thing is that it depends on if you can stop it or not. And the reason why you will not be able to stop it is because you have lost hope with life.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who do it all the time and, you know, they just live like that. It has become a normal thing for them. But then at the end of the day, some people have lost hope. And it's not only because of the drugs. It's only because of whatever it is that they are going through their lives.
Yeah.
So the ones that can sustain it.
Okay. And in terms of... Uh-huh, Renani. You were saying something still?
No, sorry, go ahead.
Okay. In terms of Namibia's current economy, do you think it's still feasible to be able to do that? I mean, unemployment rate is also very high, and perhaps also I'm talking about 3 point something million Namibian people now. Do you think it's still feasible with the way the economy, even global crises, are going at this transition?
Yes, absolutely. We were told we are too few to be poor.
Mm.
Namibians are too few to be poor. And that really means that Namibia is supposed to be a self-sustaining country. We've got all the riches that we can use to improve the living conditions of our people. And it has been done everywhere before, whereby people, the leadership started taking responsibility.
Hurry to Usaver for mega savings on household items, small electrical appliances, DIY hardware, and motor products. Listen up. Essentials kettle and steam iron, just $149.99 Namibian each. Essentials air fryer for quick meals, just $549.99 Namibian. Bush Baby portable gas stove plate and a 5-piece non-stick cookware set, just $249.99 Namibian each. Usave for luxury you can afford.
By people, the leadership started taking responsibility for certain things. You know, we now are hearing of so much corruption that are involving high-profile people. So if you were really worried about the living conditions of the people, that's the last thing you would think about is yourself. So Namibia is one of the richest countries in the world. We are number 2 or number 4, if I'm not mistaken, in exporting uranium in the world. We've got copper. We've got one of the world's richest fertile fishing grounds. We've got everything that we can ensure to make sure that we can afford a basic income grant. The only thing that it is just political will, because sometimes people forget that they were poor once, and they forgot how it felt like to be poor because they were there once. Because if you get into a powerful position, the thing that you must do is remember to get your people where you are, because nobody is supposed to be poor with all the resources that we have in the world. It's not only Africa that would have had to provide the resources. Everybody would have been able to live a good life.
Mm-hmm. Now, since the pilot study, I know the pilot study was said to be very successful within the community, within the Namibian community. And you speak that other countries took an example from us, and the results are positive throughout. Wasn't that perhaps enough to convince the people to look into the basic income grant, and why has it What do you think? Has it just faded away? Is it that perhaps it's not believed enough that it can really make impact, or it's just not taken serious? What are your thoughts?
Because the people that are in power that are supposed to change the system to make sure that we get to that level where we implement a basic income grant and make sure that everybody live a good life. They don't want it to happen for some reason. And if you cannot convince those people that this is a good thing to do so that people can live a good life, it's very, 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 very hard to do that. It would take the level of will that it took the Nordic countries like Sweden and Denmark and Finland. It would have to take, you would have to lose the ultimate selfishness of yourself to change the system to that world that you, I mean, to your life, that you would have the will to change the world to be a better place for everyone. So it is all about political will. That's what it's all about.
I hear you, Rani. What's your message to the leaders out there, or the people who would then be in charge to implement this? What are your words to them? Even though, at this point in time, is the fight for the basic income grant still there, or perhaps has died away?
It is definitely still there. It is a struggle. The reason why it is also a struggle, because you are competing with people who have 100 more million resources than you have to make sure that they also have their influence much more heard than yours. So it is definitely, definitely a struggle, because it is hard to sustain such campaigns without the proper resources that it deserves.
Mm-hmm.
It is definitely still there.
Okay. And your message to those who are in the power to be able to implement this?
All I will say is that be brave. You need to be brave for a change, because we have everything to make sure that our people live the best life that they can live, because they have all the resources. They are walking on diamonds and gold and oil and everything, and they deserve to be living good lives with the resources that they have.
Okay. Rani, thank you so much for making time for us right here. I don't know if I can really say this, but I see your concern even within your voice.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Okay. Let's pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly. Please do stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. Still have more coming your way.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
And welcome back. President Netumbo Nandi Ndaitwe has commended or has visited green schemes right in the Kabango East and Kabango West. That is accompanied, whereby she was accompanied by Minister Inge Zamani, Minister of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Land Reform, as well as Minister Charles Mubiter, that is Minister in the Presidency, alongside other dignitaries. They're visiting green schemes such as the Sekondo Green Scheme Irrigation Project, the Vunguvungu Green Scheme Project, as well as the Sekondo Green Scheme Project that is in Kabango West Region. Now, the president noted a significant improvement in agricultural output compared to previous seasons, because she's been visiting them quite frequently, even last year, I think about twice or so, when we reported quite significantly on it. Now, briefing the president, Assistant Farm Manager Lima Kativar of the Shati Kongoro Green Scheme said that despite experiencing exceptionally heavy rainfall during the season, the scheme has recorded encouraging progress. Kavita reported that the sunflower crop has already been successfully harvested, while a strong maize harvest is expected in the coming weeks. Management also outlined plans to diversify production during the next planting season through the cultivation of watermelon, pumpkin, cabbage and butternut. While all central pivots are currently fully operational, management raises concerns over aging and insufficient farming equipment, which continues to limit the scheme's ability to achieve its full production potential. Now, earlier, the president, accompanied by Inge Zamani Minister in the Presidency, Charles, arrived also at Sekondo Green Scheme Irrigation Project in the Kabango West Region, and the visit formed part of the president's ongoing familiarization tour of national green scheme projects aimed at assessing agricultural productivity, reviewing progress made since previous engagements, and reaffirming government's commitment to strengthening food security and agricultural development across the country. And I particularly appreciate the president's continuous visit to these green schemes, because they are our hope. They are our definitely. You know, Kabango is said to be Namibia's food, fruit basket, fruit and vegetable basket, something like that. They are definitely our hope when we're talking about agriculture. The green schemes are part of renewed hope. Now, during the visit, President Netumbo Nandi Ndaitwe toured maize, potato and garlic fields to assess productivity and received a briefing on the project's progress, on future plans and key operational challenges. The visit underscores government's determination to enhance agricultural production, reduce food imports and support the continued growth of Namibia's Green Scheme program. Now, regarding the Vunguvungu Green Scheme, the president welcomed the progress made at the Vunguvungu Green Scheme, expressing satisfaction after the farm achieved full utilization of its agricultural land for the very first time. And you know, I think it is Vunguvungu Green Scheme that had spoken about electricity bills up going even as far as $1 million. I believe that it was addressed. I remember so very well last year when we reported on it, that the president said she will look into it. She said she was not promising anything. And I believe that something was done. Now, regarding the Vunguvungu, now during her visit, the president assessed progress on recommendations from previous engagements. And that's the nice thing about presidents visiting such places, because they are in a capacity, in a power where they can speak and within the chain of command, direct to say, let's do this, let's do that. And there will be people who will definitely make such implementation, because they know that she will come back to us on those engagements and those recommendations that were done. So preparations for the upcoming winter harvest and the readiness of equipment and machinery for the summer planting season are also underway. Now, the Vunguvungu Green Scheme plays a key role in strengthening Namibia's food security, creating employment opportunities, supporting small-scale farmers, and driving a rural economic development through the production of maize, wheat, and various horticulture crops. And in her own words, she says, I'm happy there is good progress in terms of plantation. President Netumbo Nandi Ndaitwe said, commending management, workers and farmers for their dedication and contribution to the growth of Namibia's agricultural sector. Now, the president reaffirmed that green scheme projects will remain a priority area for oversight with annual visits and regular progress reports aimed at ensuring accountability, productivity and continued growth across the sector. And that is commendable, that is applaudable, because at the end of the day, we do want this to be practical, that we don't just talk about, we don't want to be importing from South Africa. We should learn from South Africa as well. They're doing very well in terms of agriculture, and we are neighbors and we always learn from them. And therefore, this is the time where we also need to implement our own and take tangible results into achieving rightly, doing rightly by agriculture and agricultural green schemes. Now, let's take a listen to President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah as he was engaging one of the farm owners.
A quick view on the most. Kavango is the region. We are now at the Umugongo Green Scheme. I'll give over to the manager of the project for him just to take us through.
In comparison to the previous year, I promised we will have more production. And as we stand now, the farm is planted to 100% capacity of the fields. Everything is under mass production. So we have no excuse to say we did not plant for one or other reason. It has been planted. But we have just stopped here for a quick view on the maize.
No, I have to clap hands for the increasement in the production. Thank you very much. Thank you.
It was great one. The best of the East.
Okay.
So, white maize, we sell as grade one or grade two. Hopefully, if you get into a grade three, then it is rejected. So they have only two grades, one and two.
Okay.
So what we have delivered so far is everything is more fine. We want to continue with that. I did not select, I just pick on
the top. I know that.
It is healthy. The plants were healthy. We are blessed. I'm sure we want to receive this.
Oh,
yeah.
Please continue now. Don't slow down. Just continue.
We just have to continue with the speed.
Yeah.
And then with a little fine tuning,
yeah.
We need to get the crop a bit larger.
Okay.
But in this end, it's fine. It is extremely good.
But
we will try our best. We need to improve the quality of the soil. We need to change the pH. We lift it a bit by applying lime. Then we can have a better yield.
But your yield per hectare, is it increased?
Since last year, I think we are with a problem now. We are busy with our problem. We had one of our center pivots destroyed by a windstorm, like a tornado, at 31 of March. And we had continuous rain, like almost 60 millimeters after that. So we have to pick all the crops from the plants lying on the ground.
Yeah.
We pick by hand. We put it in bags and then we put it through the combine harvest. We are still busy with that. And in the meantime, we will also do some of the other pivots in between because it's time consuming. So we have labor. The windstorm created labor for many people. We are using 120 casual laborers at the moment for picking all that maize. If nothing was fallen, then we did not need any of that. So, yeah, at least with a disaster, come some relief for us. Poor families, we are now in trouble.
Okay, thank you.
Due to irrigation for the first time,
because of,
due to intervention.
Oh, my intervention.
Yeah.
Okay.
For the first time, on the whole land.
That's what I'm trying to say.
There's no open space. We are fully planted. Everything.
So that's very important, the visit to us, and continue to start to be
it started more 3 years
ago. Yeah. Everybody is already telling you that the plantation now is over 100% capacity. It says, since your visit, this is the progress you've made.
and I just want you to continue.
Thank you very much, Excellency.
So congratulations to the manager and to the staff, all the workers. Thank you.
Okay, and there we had it, some background knowledge on what's transpiring regarding the green schemes. There are five green schemes or so that are up and running in the Kavango West region. But yeah, let's pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly. Stay tuned for more right here on the Radar News Analysis.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back, and now let's go for economic indicators and what's happening between Namibia and other economies. And then right after that, news beyond the borders follows after. Now for economic indicators, the US dollar is picking up strength against the Namibian dollar, or has picked up strength against the Namibian dollars right in the beginning of the year. Oh, actually, not the US dollar, but that was the euro. Now the US dollar is one US dollar is equal to 16 Namibian dollars point 20 cents, and 1 euro is equals to 18 Namibian dollars point 86 cents. 1 pound sterling is equals to 21 Namibian dollars point 82 cents. 1 United Arab Emirates dirham is equals to 4 Namibian dollars point 41 cents. 1 Australian dollar is equals to 11 Namibian dollars point 63 cents. 1 Chinese yuan is equals to 2 Namibian dollars point 34 cents. And now for news beyond the borders of Namibia. As usual, we start off regionally, move over to continental news, and thereafter, international news comes your way. Starting off in South Africa, where 4 have been declared dead, 2 injured in a taxi-related shooting.
Onto some breaking news this Tuesday morning. 4 people have been killed and 2 others wounded in a taxi-related shooting in Nyanga. That's in Cape Town. Police spokesperson Andre Trout says the incident occurred this morning at the corner of Moonwood Drive and Sheffield Road. The wounded victims have been taken to a medical facility for treatment. No arrests, we're told, have yet been made. SABC News reporter Mariska Buerta is watching the story and joins us now live from Nyanga. And Mariska, how far are you from the scene of the shooting?
Well, I'm right on the scene, as far as the police will allow us, because they cordon off the area. Let me step right out of shot so you can see immediately. Forensic teams are busy on the scene. The scene is still officially active. There are bodies in the back of the scene. They have been covered. So they are busy investigating at the moment. The scene is, as you said there earlier, it happened at 8 o'clock this morning. So very much still in the investigative phase on the scene, as you see it there in front of you. It's another gruesome killing spree here in Cape Town. As you said, six people shot at. Four are dead, and we can see from here three bodies that have been covered, and we understand the fourth body is lying around 100 meters from where I am now, and two others were injured. The only thing we know right now is that one of the people that have been killed was the owner of the taxi, and it is believed to be taxi-related. We cannot confirm that with certainty at the moment, but the police tells us that it is believed to be taxi-related. And, of course, we've seen a spate of killings of this nature in the Western Cape for at least the last year, and this is just another one of those. My colleague Clinton Serves just pointing to me here on the left. You see the mortuary van here. When they are done combing the scene for whatever evidence they will carry, of course, the bodies will be moved with the van to the mortuary where autopsies will be performed on the deceased as part of the investigation. So very much still an active scene. There is not much more information that we have right now other than four people have died and two have been hospitalized. And the police is busy investigating as we speak. And we arrived first on the scene here from the media contingent in the Western Cape. So when we got here, you never get used to it, to see a person lying under a sheet covered, knowing that they have passed away, knowing that it was somebody's family member that have passed away. We don't know the circumstances, but police telling us at this stage that it is believed to be taxi-related.
Yeah, certainly still very difficult to take in, despite how commonplace this is now becoming in the Western Cape, as you mentioned, Mariska. It also seems like the scene is quite close to a residential area. What's your sense of how the community there, at least since you've arrived, yes, has responded?
Well, there is a number of community members standing around you looking, of course, but people are very, very wary to speak when it comes to these things because they are afraid. People fear for their lives, as with we see with the gang shootings in other areas, in Nyanga included. Remember, Nyanga is continually listed as one of the most dangerous police precincts in the country and in the Western Cape and certainly in Cape Town. So this is a very dangerous area. There are a few shacks towards that side, and on this side it's a beautiful built-up area. Behind the camera is a lovely neighborhood with big homes and the like. So this part of Nyanga seems like it is a peaceful area, but some people will speak to you off-camera, tell you people have been warned nonstop about certain things, but they will not officially give an interview to say what they know about the incident. But certainly it is a worrying concern for people anyway when shootings like this take place, because, like I said, if they do speak to us, they run the risk of their own lives being in danger. But certainly it is something that puts fear in communities because it means the area is not safe for them.
Fair enough. Mariska Botha, live to us there with the breaking news from Nyanga in Cape Town. For now, thanks very much.
Stenhuisen boosts South Africa's foot and mouth disease fight with more vaccines.
The Agriculture Minister says South Africa remains on course in its response to the foot and mouth disease. He has announced a foot and mouth disease vaccination pipeline following a receipt of another 3.5 million doses of vaccines. Mrs. Bajo Jabs puts the total doses available to 13.5 million.
I can therefore announce that of the 3.5 million new vaccines that have landed in the country, they will be distributed as follows. 1.5 million doses will go to the feedlot industry. 500,000 doses will go to the Red Meat Producers Organization, 200,000 to the Milk Producers Organization so that they can commence with the second round of vaccination of dairy herds, 100,000 to the stud breeders industry, and just over 1 million to the provinces. We have also set aside some vaccines for regional vaccination, particularly in South Africa's neighbours.
So far, the country has vaccinated around 4 million animals across the country since the start of the foot and mouth disease outbreak. The minister says they continue to study the preliminary High Court ruling that confirmed that farmers may procure and administer foot and mouth disease vaccines without state permission.
The judgment has been studied and is being studied by the department. I do think there are profound consequences, not only for FMD, but for SAHPRA and the Medicines Control Council, because I think the ruling creates a precedent that I don't think a number of people have really thought through about what the implications are for other instances when there are crises in a country and who can import and who cannot and who can deploy and who cannot.
The Agriculture Minister says government should consider the introduction of blended financing on agriculture insurance to help farmers affected by the adverse weather conditions.
But I think what these natural disasters, and as we saw with these floods and the like, underscore is the need for us to move towards a new way of looking at agricultural insurance in South Africa. For far too long, we are obviously at the mercy of having to rely on disaster management funding. And I think that one of the things that we have to prioritize going forward is looking at how we do a blended financing model on agricultural insurance, similar to the SASRIA system, where there's a contribution by the state and there's a contribution by the producers. Current agricultural insurance is often out of reach for our small-scale family farmers, and even some mid-scale commercial farmers.
South Africa also continues to watch developments in the Middle East and its impact on movements of agricultural goods.
The biggest impact of the conflict now in the Middle East is the huge impact it's had on diesel prices, which account for around 14% of a farmer's input costs, and the massive jump in fertilizer prices, which account for around 30% of a farmer's input costs. And one of the discussions at the SADC session that I chaired of agricultural ministers last week in Zimbabwe was how do we develop regional stores of fertilizer and the materials so that we're able to produce a lot more here in the SADC region.
South Africa is working to protect and expand market access for South African livestock products despite the foot and mouth disease outbreak. The minister will this week formally engage a number of strategically important markets, including Tunisia, Lebanon, Egypt, Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia, with proposals aimed at facilitating continued trade under science and risk-based conditions. Katlego Lerodi, SABC News in Johannesburg.
President Cyril Ramaphosa retains to Parliament to deliver his 2026-2027 presidential budget.
Now we take you to President Cyril Ramaphosa, who will give feedback on the presidency's budget vote in the National Assembly at 2 o'clock this afternoon. This budget will be debated thereafter by members of Parliament. Ramaphosa is expected to respond to the debate on Wednesday at 3 o'clock. The last time the president appeared before the National Assembly, some of the opposition parties, which included MKP and EFF, marched out saying they refused to be addressed by him following the Constitutional Court judgment on the Palapala matter, which ordered Parliament to establish an impeachment committee to look into the Section 89 independent panel report. For more, we cross live now to SABC News reporter Bulelani Philip, who's in Cape Town. A very good afternoon to you, Bulelani. As we look today, to get a sense of the reaction that the president will get, especially after that incident where MPs walked out, what are the expectations ahead of Ramaphosa's budget vote?
Well, good afternoon to you, Mpo, and to the viewers at home. Of course, a budget vote 2 of the presidency will be led by President Cyril Ramaphosa. The focus, we are told, is that he's going to really dwell on issues of growing the economy, reducing poverty, and building a capable as well as an ethical state. There will be also sub-departmental allocations for the State Security Agency, the Government Communications and Information Systems, as well as Statistics South Africa. Of course, the other focus that we expect from that budget is that there is going to be announcements on how he intends to bolster an intelligence approach to dismantling organized criminal networks. Of course, we're going to get perspectives from political parties in terms of what their expectations are, both within the GNU as well as those members who are not part of the Government of National Unity. First up, I'm going to bring in now Maxolile Notata, who is the DA's deputy chief whip, as well as a member of the National Assembly. Thanks for joining us, Apex. Firstly, as the DA, what's your expectations of the president's budget vote?
Look, good afternoon, Wolan, and to your viewers as well. I mean, the budget vote is an opportunity for the president to account and to also make some commitment, especially on issues of national importance. We're going to be asking him today about how to combat crime particularly, because there is no particular state, whether it's a government nationally, provincially, or locally, that can function with criminal syndicates running those municipalities or provincial government, or in this case, the state in its entirety. And we have to have a solid plan for that, because there is no talking about growing the economy or creating jobs in an environment where there's crime. Also, the national water crisis plan that he has, because a lot of municipalities are not servicing underground infrastructure or invisible infrastructure that's supposed to provide water to communities, more importantly, to get businesses running. And there's been a national water crisis committee that has been set up, and we need to obviously see what commitments that he had made and whether has followed through with those commitments. So this is a platform to discuss progress on those issues, but more importantly, to hold the president account to his commitments and then see what the plan is moving forward, so that we're able to combat crime, we're able to deliver basic services, so that we create an environment where we can create jobs.
Briefly, I mean, the other issue that is hanging over his head, rather, is around this impeachment committee. Do you think it's going to actually dilute in terms of the debate rather than the substance of the allocations?
Look, I mean, the impeachment committee has been set up. A chairperson has been elected. The impeachment committee must now do its work. What can't stop is for us to deal with the issues that affect South Africans. And it's important for us to be able to put those on the table, action those, and the president can run with his own process in going to account to the impeachment committee. But we can't renege on the work of fighting crime, on the work of making sure that communities receive basic services, and more importantly, for us to grow the economy through reforms that we've proposed and will be proposing more today to make sure that we create jobs and lift people out of poverty. So those two can go hand in hand.
All right, thank you so much, Maxolile Notata. He is the DA's deputy chief whip. I'm going to go straight into Vuyo Zungula, who is the leader of the African Transformation Movement. I can say perhaps maybe one of the biggest critics of the president. Firstly, as the Black Progressive Caucus, have you met, and in terms of, have you outlined what's the plan of action going to this debate?
Look, what we need to put out there is that this budget debate of the president, he wants Parliament to actually approve the budget, meaning he wants Parliament to function only when it suits him, because he wants Parliament to actually do its work and approve the budget. However, on the other side, when Parliament has to hold him accountable on the impeachment matter, he wants to take Parliament to court. So that is the hypocrisy of President Ramaphosa, whereby when it suits him, Parliament must do its work, but when it does not suit him, he wants to interdict Parliament from doing its work. And the second issue, Bulelani, on the issue of why are we here? We're here because the independent panel said, upon initial investigation, the findings that he has committed serious misconduct and serious violations to the Constitution are a fact until proven otherwise. This scandal of Palapala came to the public in 2022 simply because Arthur Fraser spoke to the public, not because President Ramaphosa spoke about it. From 2020 up until now, there's no answers. And the biggest issue that people are avoiding here is that once you have someone with undeclared foreign currency, undeclared cash in his possession, one thing that raises questions is whether that person is under foreign, criminal, or corrupt influence. So we don't want a president that will table a budget debate here that is under such influences. That is why we've been pushing hard on answers and the truth when it comes to Palapala.
I'm almost out of time. I mean, As the ATM and other opposition parties, are you going to participate in the debate or are we going to see a walkout this afternoon?
We are going to participate and expose his lies, his hypocrisy, on how he's undermining South Africans. He's committed to be transparent. Remember when he came in, he promised a new dawn, renewal. Where is that renewal and new dawn now when he has to be held accountable? He promised accountable and transparent leadership. Do South Africans know the truth about Palapala? The answer is no. Instead of allowing a process that will bring the truth to South Africans, what is he doing? He's going to court, trying to stop that process. So our participation today is to basically expose him for the liar that he is.
All right, thank you so much, Vuyo Zungula, the leader of the African Transformation Movement. Of course, much anticipation, and you can follow those proceedings starting at 2 o'clock on SABC News, Channel 404. On that note, we cross back to you in studio.
Thank you very much, SABC News reporter Bulelani Philip, head of the...
Welcome back. And now for in other news, Kenya's proposed Ebola facility. No, before we move to that, let's talk about the health experts' concern of rising vaping addiction among South African youths.
Tobacco shops look more like candy stores these days, a sign of the times, perhaps, as more and more young people move away from traditional smoking. Research from the University of Pretoria's Africa Centre for Tobacco Industry Monitoring and Policy Research indicates a significant rise in smoking and vaping among South Africans aged 16 to 34 over the last 15 years. From 2011 to 2025, cigarette smoking prevalence increased from 15.3% to 27.3%. while vaping rose from 0.3% to 11.1%.
The tobacco industry and the vaping industry has evolved over time. They're basically moving from selling a product to selling image, selling masculinity, selling flavors, so that the young people do not see this as buying something addictive. They're actually seeing it as buying a lifestyle.
Whilst there are an increasing number of programs available to help people quit smoking and vaping, it's become difficult to motivate young people to stop. But that doesn't mean efforts have stopped.
There are young people who have not even smoked before. So we've now increased the number of nicotine addicts, essentially. We've expanded nicotine addiction in the country.
South Africa's laws strictly prohibit cigarette sales to under 18s. Smoking in public use facilities, restaurants and offices is also not allowed. And all tobacco advertising was banned over a decade ago. South Africa is now debating stronger marketing controls, which is angering tobacco companies.
What we found in terms of the tactics that are used by the tobacco industry is that currently the way, for instance, e-cigarettes and vapes are marketed, they often say that this can be used as a cessation tool. But when we look at the marketing tactics, we find vapes that come in sleek designs in different colors.
The challenge now is getting people to accept that vaping and nicotine use is harmful to their health.
As difficult as it might be to quit, it is possible. We've seen a number of cases from the National Council Against Smoking that we've been able to help in quitting.
Health experts say South Africa's tobacco control challenge is no longer about smoking. It is about stopping newer nicotine products from reaching young people before addiction takes hold, while helping those already hooked to quit. Sumitra Nadu, CGTN, Johannesburg.
Okay. Kenya's proposed Ebola facility sparks debates.
In Kenya, a deal between Kenya and the United States for a quarantine facility for U.S. citizens exposed to Ebola is facing legal challenges. The Kenyan High Court temporarily suspended the deal pending determination of the case challenging the deal. Our reporter, Wukisa Nyabwa, is here in studio with me. Wukisa, it's quite a legal dilemma for the Kenyan government here. What are the grounds laid out so far by those opposed to this deal? And also tell us where we are on this case.
Well,
Penina, there have been quite a number of voices objecting to this idea, and one of the loudest voices has been the Maine Doctors Union, which has thousands and thousands of members, and it has been raising an objection, basically asking how the decision was made, given that Kenya is not the epicenter of the current outbreak of Ebola, and that the country has to date not registered a single case, and therefore wondering how the country was chosen, but also complaining that there hadn't been much transparency in the selection of, and really the decision to select Kenya. And another voice that has been very loud is the Katiba Institute. And indeed, it is the Katiba Institute that moved to court registering its complaint, making a legal challenge. The Katiba Institute also brought up issues, questions about transparency in the process, but also asked whether Kenya had capacity, really, to deal with an outbreak of this magnitude of the current Ebola outbreak, and basically just asking the government to be more transparent, more open, but also to take into account the voices of Kenyans and basically subject this to public participation. And now let's listen in to what Katiba Institute had to say about its legal challenge.
We felt the need to go to court when we learned that the U.S. was intending to put an isolation facility for Ebola cases in Kenya, because we had not, in fact, received any information from our own government on this issue. There had been no transparency around impact assessments, around contingency measures, around the procedure by which this was approved by Parliament.
So, Wokista, this deal isn't just opposed by the doctors or the civil society groups, but also ordinary Kenyans. What are their sentiments about it?
Well, Kenyans have been very loud on social media, but also just out in public. And we have seen a number of Kenyans also just raising the same questions, saying that raising issues about transparency as well, saying that this deal basically came to light when it seemed to have been a done deal, and asking whether the country had capacity to ensure containment of the virus and what it would mean if the virus breached containment, and just asking what it would mean to members of the public, and a number of them in Laikipia, which is now has been identified as apparently the site where this quarantine facility is to be set up at the military barracks. A number of Kenyans just came out to the streets to register their disgruntlement and to bring out their grievances and some of the issues that came out. And we did arrive there, and we also got some sound bites and to hear from what the Kenyans who took to the streets had to say.
President Ruto hasn't done well agreeing to this Ebola facility in Kenya. The U.S. have their own country. They can build their own facility there. I fear for the workers at the Laikipia Air Base. If they contract Ebola, they'll spread it to other people.
This government should not bring us what is not needed in other countries. Our country is ours, and theirs is theirs. We don't want Ebola. Just because they have been given money for preparedness efforts like COVID-19 doesn't mean they should allow the facility here. We don't need it in Laikipia. I am a father, and my fear is if I contract Ebola, my children will be fatherless.
So in the midst of all of this opposition, Wokista, has the Kenyan government said anything at all about this deal? And if yes, what?
Well, the Kenyan government hasn't gone too deep into the matter, but we did see the health ministry releasing a statement and trying to address this, basically speaking about the importance of international partnerships and cooperation, and saying that these partnerships would enable the country perhaps to prepare itself in the face of global health threats, which Ebola is listed under, but hasn't really gone too deep into that. And the principal secretary for health also spoke about this and basically touched on this topic.
Anything that comes from an international request, it goes by the laws of Kenya. So we will not be breaking the law to have a conversation with partners, not just the U.S., but any other partner. It goes by the laws of Kenya. So we want to affirm that our country is, we are ready, we are capable, and the ministry, we have done all, we have taken all actions to ensure that we continue being guided by our healthcare workers and our policies to protect our boundaries and also to ensure that every Kenyan is very, very safe.
Well, this is very much a developing story, Wilkesa. Thank you very much for those insights you've shared with us. My colleague Wilkesa Nyabo speaking to us about that deal, the Ebola quarantine facility deal between Kenya and the U.S.
And now in other news, Ebola recoveries rise, but so does the number of cases.
We begin with our coverage of the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Data from the Communications Ministry shows total confirmed cases have jumped to 282, with 42 dead. That's after 19 new positive test results were recorded. The outbreak is currently outpacing global response, with more than 1,100 suspected cases in the DRC and neighboring Uganda under investigation. Outside Africa, Brazil and Italy are testing suspected cases tied to African travel. One patient in Brazil tested positive for meningitis and a second tested positive for malaria, but local health authorities say the diagnoses do not rule out the possibility of Ebola. The Italian traveller has tested negative for Ebola. Meanwhile, recoveries are also on the rise, offering a glimmer of hope. Four frontline nurses in the hard-hit Congolese city of Bunia have been discharged. This now brings the total number of recoveries to five after a lab worker recovered last week. The WHO chief, Tedros Ghebreyesus, who's visiting Bunia, says the current strain can be survived with good medical care. He's meeting with government officials and ambassadors today in the capital, Kinshasa, to continue coordinating the response. Our correspondent, Chris Ochamringa, is joining us live now from Kinshasa. Chris, what's the latest on the WHO Director General's meetings in Kinshasa today, and what are we expecting?
So Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus is set to meet with the DRC Prime Minister, a number of ambassadors, and they're going to be discussing how they can work together to support the DRC to stop this disease from spreading further. And he's also later expected to meet President Felix Tshisekedi and discuss the coordination of this response effort. His central message has been that the DRC is not alone. The World Health Organization and other international partners will stand by the DRC to ensure that this outbreak is contained before it spreads further. They have committed to mobilize more resources to help the government to deal with this outbreak. And he also launched a clarion call for all the warring parties, the DRC government troops and the rebels in Ituri and North Kivu province, to silence the guns so that the health workers can move around freely to track people who have been infected with this disease, because it's a very tedious exercise. Health workers have to move from one area to another looking for suspected cases, isolate them, and that can only happen if there's peace and the situation, you know, the rebels are not attacking people. So that is one of his key messages, and he hopes that the government will also step up the security in that area so that the disease can be brought to an end.
Right. Chris, four nurses have been discharged over the weekend after a full recovery, and there was another recovery announced last week. Talk to us about the impact of such good news of recovery from Ebola, and not just for the families involved, but also for the doctors and the country at large.
So there is the recovery of these four patients, and the one who was announced last week has really raised the hopes of millions of Congolese, because when this outbreak was officially declared on May 15th, we're told that this strain that is circulating there, the Bundibugyo strain, has no vaccine or specific medication. And that really dampened the hopes of very many people. We're told that in Ituri province, there's some people who started going to churches to pray. Others were going to traditional healers because they lost hope in the medical personnel. They said there's no particular, specific medicine that will heal this disease. And that created a serious problem. People were not really going to health workers. So this news is really bolstered the hopes of health officials in the DRC. They're telling people that, look, this disease can be stopped. It can be cured if people are taken to health workers early, because they are given fluids, They're put on oxygen and given some supportive care, medicine that can treat the symptoms of Ebola, like fever, headache, diarrhea, and vomiting. It's only when people wait until, you know, their internal organs are really damaged that the health workers cannot do much. So that is very, very good news, and they're hoping that people will now start showing up to health facilities to get treatment. Beatrice?
Yeah, and Chris, talk to us or take us through the protocol during and after such discharge from Ebola treatment centers.
So after these people are discharged, there's normally a post-Ebola kind of program that they are put under to keep monitoring them for any lingering symptoms that might keep persisting after, you know, they have been declared free of Ebola. And then they're also counseled on infection prevention control measures, what they need to do to avoid, you know, contracting this disease again. And also they're given some psychosocial support to prepare them to go back to their community. Now, that's a very important issue because there's a lot of stigma. There are people in these communities who know that these people contracted Ebola, and they'll keep shunning them even after they have been cured of this contagious disease. Our health workers also give them a certificate, which is very important for them to go around, like if they're looking for a job and need to integrate in the community, to show that that is the proof that they have no more, they do not have Ebola in their blood anymore. And this is something that authorities here have been encouraging people to accept these people in their community, not to shun them. In 2018, when there was another Ebola outbreak in North Kivu province, there was a big problem about stigma, people not being integrated in the community. So this is what they're going to be going through so that these people go back to their ordinary lives.
All right, Chris, thank you very much for that. Chris Ochamringa, live for us there in Kinshasa.
Meanwhile, China sends medical team to DRC, Congo, in order to fight the Ebola virus. And Togo hikes fuel prices.
The cost of fuel is up across Togo. The government says the hikes are unavoidable, blaming the surge on global crude oil prices.
According to information shared by the official authorities, this is mainly due to import pressures linked to the situation in the Strait of Hormuz, which, as we know, caused oil prices to surge dramatically before falling back around the $100 mark after starting the year near $70. This comes at a time when Togo was one of the last countries in the region to maintain.
In the streets of the capital, Lome, motorcycle taxi drivers are among the first to feel the pinch. With fierce competition and low-income customers, many of them say they cannot afford to pass on the extra cost.
This increase in the price of fuel, we can say, doesn't benefit us at all. The price isn't right. We have diplomas, but we can't find proper jobs. We manage with this Zemijan motorcycle taxi work, and now they have increased the price of fuel again. This needs to be reviewed.
The increase in fuel prices is a severe blow for us motorcycle taxi drivers, as the cost of living is becoming increasingly difficult across the country. Even our customers, who are often market traders, may be forced to raise the prices of food products due to higher transportation costs.
The impact is also spreading quickly to the markets. Traders fear higher transport costs will push up the price of basic goods in a country where most people depend on the informal economy.
We who don't have our own means of transport, with the increase in fuel prices, how much more will we have to pay for the transportation of goods? This will force us to raise the prices of food products, and it will become expensive for the population.
Economists warn the ripple effects could raise the cost of living across the board.
The truth is that when oil prices rise, everything rises. When transport costs increase, everything increases. We can expect a knock-on effect on oil products, which will put pressure on the cost of living. Life will become relatively more expensive. Alongside this, I imagine, I dare to hope that there are negotiations and discussions at the level of public authorities to find targeted support measures.
As Togolese absorb this latest fuel shock, many are now looking to the authorities for measures to protect the most vulnerable. Najma Abdulzak, CGTN.
In other news, Iran and U.S. carry out fresh strikes while Israel Hezbollah conflict escalates.
Hello, welcome. I'm Catherine Biarahanga. Both the United States and Iran are claiming to have launched strikes on targets over the weekend near the Strait of Hormuz, straining the already fragile ceasefire. The U.S. military says it conducted what it called self-defense strikes on Iranian radar and command and control sites for drones. In a statement, U.S. Central Command said the strikes took place on Saturday and Sunday on Keshem Island and the small city of Goruk. The statement said the strikes were measured and deliberate in response to aggressive Iranian actions, including the shooting down of a U.S. drone operating over international waters. The statement goes on to say U.S. fighter aircraft swiftly responded by eliminating Iranian air defenses, a ground control station, and two one-way attack drones that pose clear threats to ships transiting regional waters. It ends by saying no American service members were harmed. Meanwhile, the diplomatic push for a deal between the U.S. and Iran continues, but it's unclear if any progress has been made. U.S. media has reported that President Trump requested edits to the proposed agreement. The BBC's U.S. news partner CBS is reporting that the changes are related to the Strait of Hormuz and the removal of highly enriched uranium. Iran's foreign minister confirmed the talks were ongoing.
Talks and message exchanges are ongoing, and until there's a clear outcome, they can't be judged. All current speculation and conjecture, in my view, should be disregarded until matters become definitive.
Now, meanwhile, in the past hour, the Israeli Prime Minister has ordered the IDF to carry out fresh strikes on the southern suburbs of Beirut. In a statement, Benjamin Netanyahu said this was due to what he called repeated violations of the ceasefire by Hezbollah. Earlier, France, Germany and the UK all criticised Israel's push further into southern Lebanon as it escalates its campaign against Hezbollah. The United Nations Security Council is due to hold a meeting on the issue later today. Well, let's get the very latest from our correspondents in Jerusalem and in Beirut. We'll start with Yolande Nell, who's in Jerusalem for us. So, Yolande, it looks like there was some military action over the weekend, and now this statement from Israel about carrying out more strikes in Beirut.
Yes, so if we look first of all at what's been happening in the Gulf, this is another strain on the two-month ceasefire between the U.S. and Israel and Iran, with the U.S. saying that it hit these Iranian targets in and next to the Strait of Hormuz, and that saying that this was Iranian air defenses, a ground control station, and also two Iranian drones that have been threatening commercial shipping. The language that we've got from the U.S. is very similar to that we heard last week when it talked about similar exchanges of fire that went on, referring to these as being in self-defense, and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard saying that it then struck a U.S. airbase from which these attacks had been launched. And you've got Kuwait, where a major U.S. airbase is located, saying that sirens sounded across the country, that they intercepted missiles and drones. There's also from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard this statement where it says if the aggression's repeated, the response will be completely different in the scale and nature, and the responsibility for that will be with the U.S. And it just reminds us how fragile this ceasefire looks, how quickly there could be a more sort of serious escalation that could really threaten those ongoing efforts to secure a ceasefire.
Nonetheless, this has brought us to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Reader News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Onkonana Dengue program, this time brought to you by Matthias Sangara. From Indafa, happy Juju. It is goodbye and have yourself a wonderful Monday afternoon ahead. Goodbye. Tuesday afternoon, pardon me.